The Guardian.
Welcome to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Drama-rama in the Champions League as Chelsea share 8 goals with the 9 men of Ajax, whose centre-backs both see red in the space of a minute. Kyle Walker takes the gloves after Man City have their sub-goalkeeper sent off. Victory for Liverpool and Spurs inch them closer to qualification for the knockout stages. Europa League action on a Wednesday afternoon, something a little bit different. But Arsenal conceding an equaliser for the 4th game in a row wasn't. We'll look ahead to the Lionesses' first game at Wembley in 5 years and to this weekend's Premier League, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On today's panel, Nikki Bandini, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. What have you been up to?
Watching Champions League football mostly this week, which has been largely wildly entertaining.
Yes, hasn't it just? Philippe Auclair.
Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. We're going to delve into Chelsea with you shortly. Mm-hmm. I know you were there. Barry Glendening, I'm not tap dancing. You're in a grump already this morning.
I'm not in a
grump.
It's
not a good start.
I'm not in a grump.
That's just Baz.
I just pointed out that you haven't done your intro, recorded your intro yet. Basically, our listeners are listening to a lie. I don't like being plunged straight in without hearing an intro, and I pointed out that you could have come prepared.
You wanted a warm-up act. That's what you wanted. Right, well, tough.
But I'm not in a grump.
Right, good.
Yes.
So you shouldn't be. Well, you won't be, because we've had so many goals. A cracking Champions League game week, as Nikki said. 29 goals scored on Tuesday. Add Wednesday's 27 goals, and that, if my maths is correct, makes this match day round the highest scoring in group stage history with 56 goals. So let's start with the 8-goal thriller at Stamford Bridge. This match had absolutely everything. And Philippe, you lucky devil, you were there.
Yeah, I was there. And I genuinely enjoyed myself. And I think everybody enjoyed themselves at the ground. It was wild. It was rather wonderful. I think Barney got it right when he wrote about the game, and saying that some people would query the defensive frailties of Chelsea or the refereeing or this and that. But that would be ridiculous. It was a game to enjoy fully between two teams which are probably, I think, two of the most exciting in the competition this year. But again, I left with the impression that this Ajax team is just simply wonderful. And is perhaps even as good as it was last year?
I was worried you were about to say I left, because I'm sure there will have been some Chelsea fans who did and would then be absolutely gutted.
There was a caller to TalkSport. There was a caller to TalkSport who, I think in quite good humour about it, but acknowledged that for only the second time in his Chelsea-watching life had left at 4-1.
And
this call after the 90th minute, so having sort of seen where it went down, yes, missed all of it.
I can't bear things like that. Look, this is not Champions League related, it's Luton Town related, I'm afraid. But we were playing Fulham the other week, and my husband was like, I've got a really early start, can we leave early? And that was at 3-1. And we were being, not trounced, but, you know, we weren't going to win the game. And then just as we were leaving, and I say, I don't leave games early, just as we were leaving, we scored 3-2 to make an exciting climax, and I was really cross about it. Anyway, I digress. A wild start to this game. Ajax scoring after 2 minutes, giving a penalty away a minute later. Jorginho getting the equaliser within 4 minutes of kickoff. I mean, it was breathless, wasn't it? Just the opener.
Yes, the opener, to be honest, I mean, people have said, again, it's Chelsea on set pieces and so forth. Well, it's a known goal. If Tammy Abraham actually makes good contact with the ball, nobody's talking about it. I think it was a case, we were, I think, all a bit surprised the first leg in Amsterdam, how good Chelsea were at preventing Ajax from playing. But we've forgotten, perhaps, that Ajax are actually better away from home than in front of their own public. And they gave an absolute masterclass that night. I thought, against a very enterprising, very good Chelsea side, but first 15 minutes, actually, Chelsea looked brilliant. Kovacic, you know, running the ball from deep in his own half, and Jorginho finding these wonderful passes that we'd forgotten he could give. Perhaps a little bit lack of cutting edge, but all in all, I mean, an absolutely magnificent game of football, and with some star performances. I think Ziyech was simply extraordinary, and you have to wonder, I think he's got some, like a release clause, which is 35 million, something like that, and you wonder why nobody's picked on that, because he was already that good last season. But It's great. It's absolutely lovely. And in the end, it leaves us with a group which is wide open.
Yeah.
Because to be honest, I was a bit surprised when I saw Lille was leading at Valencia 1-0. I thought, hey, at long last, they've got what they deserve. Because Lille haven't played that badly, actually. They've been punished every time they've made a mistake. And then they completely crumbled. So now we've got three teams on 7 points.
Yeah, we have. All on seven, as you say. Ajax, Chelsea, Valencia, Lille with just the 1 point. That's after Valencia's 4-1 win over Lille. They scored all of their four goals in the last 25 minutes. But
it's almost like a theme to the week, isn't it?
I know.
Late
goals, exactly. But at 3-1 up, Ajax had actually only just had one shot on target because Tammy Abraham got his leg on one. And then that comedy moment where Kepa's own goal, where he faced it into the... I mean, you could just watch that on repeat.
Yeah, it's an amazing number of footballers both involved in this game and not who've already sort of used that meme on Twitter. I saw Martin Deroon using it for Atalanta even, but I know Michy Batshuayi right afterwards put welcome to the meme club on Twitter. I'll slightly disagree with Philippe about everyone enjoying themselves because Erik ten Hag afterwards very much seemed quite like he wasn't a man who'd enjoyed himself on the evening. And I do understand. I think we probably do have to talk about that double red card situation in a second. But while we're still in the fun part of it, we were all talking just before we came on, but Kurt Zouma's run just needs to be brought up because Chelsea are 3-1 down at that time. And he, you know, if anyone hasn't seen it, Kurt Zouma just goes on this sort of gallop up the pitch from centre half, which ends with just the most wonderful pair of step overs. It's sort of he's a big man, Kurt Zouma, and he's got these big legs, and not just sort of long legs, but chunky legs. And when he's doing these step overs, there's just huge sweeps over the ball, and it's so brilliant to watch. And then suddenly at the last second, he remembers he's a centre back and pelts it 20 yards over the bar. And it cut to Frank Lampard, whose team is losing 3-1 at home in a Champions League tie, and he's laughing because it's you can't not because it's such a sort of brilliantly odd moment.
One of the best goals never scored.
Yeah.
But Phil Neville is no longer the purveyor of the most ponderous step overs in football history.
He looked almost balletic though, I thought.
It was beautiful, honestly. I can watch it over and over.
I mean, the other thing which was remarkable and which would have really put, you know, the cherry on the cake for Ten Hag actually, was the fact that the way Ajax played when they're down to nine men was quite breathtaking. So you were, you know, rubbing your eyes thinking, are they really pressing by the corner flag, by Chelsea's corner flag, 3v3 at 9v11?
That they're such an exciting team to watch. For anybody who's not seen the game, we should put into context why they were down to nine men. So Ajax went 4-1 up, Chelsea got one back, and then Daily Blink goes and puts in two tackles, either of which he could have got a yellow for. The ref lets the play continue. Hudson-Odoi's shot then hits Joel Veltman's arm, penalty, and both centre-backs receive their second yellows of the game and are sent off. I don't think I've seen anything like that. Have you seen anything like that, Philippe?
No, it's happened before that two centre-backs would be sent off within a few minutes of each other, but in the same action. Never. Well, I haven't found any other occurrence of this.
I'm interested to hear what other people thought of it because I can see what Ten Hag's complaint is, which is right before Blint's first foul, he tangles with Jorginho. And I think you could make a case that Jorginho fouls him. I think you could put that under seen them given. I don't know if I see it as clear cut even after a few watches, but you've seen them given. So if the play stops there, then neither of the subsequent fouls happen. After that, I have to say, it's incredibly harsh on Ajax. It's incredibly unfair in a sort of sense of just it doesn't seem right. But in terms of the actual refereeing of it, I think Gianluca Rocchi does a great job because he lets the play run, from which Chelsea are creating a chance. And on the current interpretation of the law, which again, I don't necessarily like, but that is a handball from Veltman. Like his arm is... this unnatural position thing is a real sort of dip into the weeds, but his arm is outside of his silhouette and it stops the ball going through. I think both of those fouls by the letter of the law you give and they're both bookable offences. So I feel really sorry for Ajax. I think it seems unfair in like an emotional sense, but I think from a refereeing sense, if we say that we don't view that Jorginho tangle with Bent as a foul, which maybe it should be. If that's a foul, then stop. But if it's not, then everything after that, I think Rocky's got spot on.
I felt sorry for the commentators of that game all around the world, because how on earth you keep up with that? Jorginho then goes on to score the penalty. Chelsea gets a 4-3. And then Reece James, 19-year-old fullback, scores the equaliser. I watched a lot of him when he was playing for Wigan last season. He is phenomenal. I'm so chuffed he's getting his chance. But what a prospect, Barry.
Yeah, it was a good finish. He was clearly delighted. I must confess, I don't know a huge amount about him, so perhaps you could tell me what it is that impressed you so much.
He got player of the season 2 years in a row while he was on loan at Wigan, and for a loany player to get that.
At the age of 17 and 18, then.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, he's just got a stature that completely goes against his age. He's very impressive.
He also sounds very mature. A few times I've heard him speak, it's very, a guy who is very much together. And the thing is that his introduction did change the game. Mm-hmm. It was not just an introduction, it was also the fact that Marcos Alonso, who'd stank the place up during the first half, every single attack from Ajax was coming down Marco Alonso's side, and it was not a coincidence. But when the switch happened and SP went to the left and Reece went to the right, suddenly it changes everything. The dynamic of the game has changed. So well done to Lampard, by the way, for doing this, which was not an obvious call, even though taking off Alonso was one. And yes, he's been very impressive, and also his quality of crossing quality is superb.
You then said Ajax played really well with nine men.
Incredible.
But Chelsea also obviously put their foot on the gas, and Aspilicueta scored what looked to be the winner. A knee slide into the corner flag, kissing his captain's armband, and then it's ruled out for handball.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he laughs. And I think it's all we do. Yeah. Okay.
But again, it's the interpretation of the law now. This is because it leads to a goal. It's just if it strikes numb, it doesn't even have to be outside the silhouette, the way they're doing it with attacking moves. That's the rule. I do think it's worth sort of raising as well how, because at that point there was still more than 10 minutes to go.
Oh yeah.
And Chelsea were so sort of head of steam in that moment. You thought they would score again anyway, but it is that thing again of how VAR can suck the energy out of a team and out of a moment. Like, it did feel like that being disallowed after the pause just killed the momentum a little bit as well.
The only thing, though, you have to say in terms of refereeing, I thought the referee was excellent. The refereeing was excellent too. The only thing that really puzzled me is why we only had 4 minutes at the time.
Yeah.
That was really puzzling when you've had so many calls, substitutions, two red cards, 4 minutes showing up. That's
things,
not much,
things
is
like
it?
That annoy me. The rule of thumb is 30 seconds per substitution, 30 seconds per goal, 30 seconds per red. So, yeah, that does not add up.
It was similar in the Manchester City game.
Yeah, that was 7 minutes. It still didn't feel like enough.
Oh, it should have been at least 10.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to that now. We've already nodded to Valencia 4, Lille 1, which makes Group H very, very tight. But Atalanta 1, Manchester City 1. Good opener for City. Sterling winning it back and then finishing the move from a back heel from Jesus.
No, I was bowing to Nicky because I was. It's Atalanta that I was interested in, because I couldn't quite understand why a team that's been so brilliant in its own league could be so poor in terms of results. And to be honest, the way they started the game, they could have been 3-0 down within, 20 minutes or so?
Yeah, well, another momentum game, I would say, actually, because they were horrible in the first half. And it was after Jesus misses the penalty, and a really bad penalty miss from Jesus, the mood inside the stadium seemed to change a little bit. To unpick why Atalanta have disappointed in the Champions League overall, I think there's sort of stages to it. I think they went to Zagreb just massively naive to how good Zagreb were going to be and got caught cold and battered by them. I thought they were quite unlucky to lose at home to Shakhtar Donetsk. I thought they played well. And then they went away to Man City and simply got outclassed. I mean, the way Atalanta play under Gasperini, it's very much explicitly even, it's not even like this is me revealing something he's talked about in interviews. He basically trusts his players to do everything one-on-one. He goes all across the pitch, we're going to engage in one-on-one battles. And when you play a game against a team like City that's just manifestly better than you in talent, usually what will happen is you'll get outplayed. That's definitely what happened in the away game, even though they took the lead. What's interesting is that I felt like in that away game, Atalanta came out all guns blazing, got that early goal, but never tried to manage the game. It seemed to me like here, and maybe it wasn't even deliberate, maybe it's just because there's sort of been this series, I think, for the Italian clubs of Champions League and midweek rounds stacking against each other. So there's probably some tired legs there, but Atalanta just started at a much slower pace. But then they were able to find that second gear later in the game rather than have it all burned out in the first half. They, by the end of the game, were looking the more likely team to win it, especially once Claudio Bravo gets himself sent off. Although, I mean, always a joy to see an outfield player in goal. Again, for anyone who missed it, Edison gets taken off at halftime for being injured. Claudio Bravo then storms out of his area to try and interrupt a Josip Iličić attack, and just, I mean, he does take him down. Iličić leaves a leg hanging very, very far from his body to make sure he gets caught. The thing that I thought subsequently, because at the time you think, wow, second keeper off, Kyle Walker in goal, this is bad for Man City, it's going to end badly. But actually, if Iličić just stays on his feet, he should score. If he doesn't go looking so hard for that foul, he's past the keeper and it's an open net. And I don't really think he needs to go down at all. I think he's worked really hard to get that foul.
But at least we got to see Kyle Walker in goal.
And he did make
really.
A save.
Well, just a bit.
He saved a free kick, and apart from that, Manchester City managed to keep Atlanta at bay enough so that I think he only got one other touch.
Well, he saved the free kick immediately after he came on, and that actually meant that he had more saves than both Bravo and Edison. So Adam Hurry tweeted, £50 million Kyle Walker becomes the third most expensive goalkeeper of all time.
Excellent.
I mean, I quite liked the suggestion as well that this was just the natural progression of Pep Ball. We're now just fully doing away with goalkeepers, put Kyle Walker in goal and we're there.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. After the match on Sky Italia, Fabio Capello asked Pep Guardiola, why did you substitute your goalkeeper at half-time? And Guardiola replied, he was a little bit injured. I've done some really stupid things as a manager, but I've never taken off a keeper who wasn't injured, which is a fair enough point. To be honest, my first thought was, well, what was wrong with him? Is he saving him for Liverpool?
Well, Liverpool Twitter are reading all sorts of things into... some of the more, paranoid members of Liverpool Twitter, so Liverpool Twitter, as they are known, they're reading all sorts into it. It's more mind games by Pep. You know, he's fingering his temples and sending out vibes.
Oh, this has been going on since the weekend as well, hasn't it?
Nonsense.
Absolutely ridiculous.
But, yeah, apparently he has some sort of knock. He might be fit, he might not. No one knows.
Well, yeah. Another
he would be a big loss for that game.
He would be a huge loss. We are going to go more in depth previewing that game later on in the pod. I just want to go back to the first half, VAR, but in a positive way, because obviously in the Champions League, they're allowed to go and have a look at the VAR screen, which makes sense. So Sterling took a free kick at 1-0, which hit Josip Iličić on the arm. So the ref went to look at the screen and gave a penalty. Unfortunately, though, Gabriel Jesus, Diana Rossed it.
Yeah.
I'd like it if the goal had fallen apart like it did. Yeah. To the silence of me.
Comedy.
It was a pretty bad penalty. I didn't think it was as bad as people were making out. I've seen a lot worse.
Simone Zaza comes to mind.
Yeah, but he's getting absolute pelters for it. I mean, he's rolled it, yard wide of the upright.
Yeah.
It could have been a hell of a lot worse. But
he gets paid a lot of money. Was this fair enough that we criticise him for not scoring?
You get paid a lot of money. You didn't write an intro.
How do you know how much I get paid?
I know.
I'm sure nobody else cares, but on the sort of other thing of Atalanta not doing as well in Europe, they are playing these games at San Siro, which is not their home ground.
Yes.
And to me, it was always a thing that people weren't thinking about enough. I mean, I remember when Arsenal used to play games at Wembley and it was a catastrophe in the Champions League. Playing your home games, which is so important in Europe, away from your home ground, even if you think, wow, we're going to get to play in a bigger stadium and potentially have more fans there, I think it's really rarely good for a club in terms of results.
Pardon my ignorance, but how far is Bergamo from Milan?
It's not far. I mean, it's there were more than 30,000 fans there.
They created quite the din, as far as I could tell.
Yeah. But it's not just about crowd noise, is it? I think talked about this years ago this came up on the podcast, and we were talking about what's, you know, why is home advantage a thing, especially in the Premier League nowadays, where often atmospheres really aren't that hot, and it's a comfort level that players have. It's a thing that I think someone at the time raised Thierry Henry even talking about it once. Like, when you're at home, you know where you are on the pitch, maybe even from something as mundane as an advertising hoarding. Like, you recognize that advertising hoarding, and so you have a sense of your exact place, how far you are from goal, how far you are from the sidelines, from your relation to certain landmarks.
So, I remember Lee Dixon even talking about a couple of season ticket holders whom we'd known for ages, and he could see where he was on the pitch just by looking at the faces in the front rank of the audience. It makes a huge difference. Also, the dimensions are not necessarily the same. The light is not the same. All these factors, you know, contribute to this home advantage, basically.
I desperately hope it was the same old man who used to sit with his, I guess, grandson in the junior gunner section near me and used to insist angrily every game that Lee Dixon was useless.
Ooh.
I really hope that was him, the season to get hold of that he was looking at.
Oh, so nothing changes at Arsenal then. Both also in the group, another extraordinary game. I mean, there were so many, weren't there, over Tuesday and Wednesday. Dinamo Zagreb leading Shakhtar Donetsk 3-1 in the 93rd minute. This was a belter, wasn't it, Nicky?
Oh, I mean, this game, I'm glad you've brought it up, because I feel like for English audience, maybe wouldn't have sort of captured the attention as much, but it was absolutely bonkers. So Shakhtar and Dynamo going into this game, especially with Atalanta on 0 points and playing City, these are the two sort of clear favourites to get second place in the group. Whoever wins this game is in the driving seat, in theory. Shakhtar go 1-0 up away from home, comes back to 1-1. In the 75th minute, still 1-1, Zagreb have Nicola Moro sent off. Then, so you think Shakhtar, right, extra man chance to win this game. Then they get a player sent off. Gets to the 83rd minute, Dynamo go 2-1 up. 89th minute, they go 3-1 up. You know, this is really putting them on the brink of the knockout rounds, because they'd have the tiebreaker over both Shakhtar and Atalanta at that point, in effect. Shakhtar pull one goal back in the 92nd minute. In the 5th minute of injury time, Shakhtar get a corner. Everyone's up, even the goalkeeper. I can't remember who it is dribbling into the box. Someone comes dribbling into the box, goes down, penalty is given, VAR looks at it. Everyone at home is watching on replays and saying, well, that's a dive, he's not fouled, so it's not going to get given. But the VAR picks up in the middle of the box. The goalkeeper, Pyatov, who's come forward, gets elbowed in the head. So it is a penalty, just not for the incident that anyone's looking at. This penalty gets scored. It finishes 3-3. And actually, ridiculously, brings even Atalanta back into play for that second spot now, because Zagreb and Shakhtar both have City still to play. So if neither of them beat City, and they'd have to beat them to guarantee finishing ahead of Atalanta at this point, and Atalanta win both of their last two games, which is a big if, given that they haven't won any yet, but if they did, they would go through. So it means that that group behind City, who still technically, I think, still need another point to guarantee their spot, but behind City, it's basically still wide open.
Group C looking like this: Manchester City top on 10 points, Shakhtar Donetsk on 5, along with Dynamo Zagreb and Atalanta propping up the table with 1. In Group B, Spurs perhaps needed a bit of a confidence boost, and they got it on Wednesday night in Belgrade, running out 4-0 winners over Red Star. They beat them 5-0 at home as well, so it was a rare easy game for them, Philippe.
I would qualify the easy game, because they actually conceded quite a few chances to Red Star early on in the game. I mean, from 2-0 on, it was, you know, the game was effectively game over. But before that, it was not quite as one-sided as the scoreline would make you guess. But on the other hand, the result is excellent. They've now got a good chance of going through. They also, I mean, many of us were wondering what the impact of the game against Everton would be on the way the players played. In the case of Son, we saw that it had clearly no impact. Certainly in the way that he played, it had an impact on the way he celebrated. I think that was very much a little hello to Andre Gomez, and to say, you know, hope you're doing all right after the operation. But an important result, but perhaps not quite as convincing as the scoreline would suggest. Yeah.
Red Star tend not to be a pushover at home. You know, they're a completely different prospect at the Maracanã. And interesting, actually, the players, they don't warm up on the pitch before the game. They go to a separate training pitch to warm up, so their fans are building into this frenzy, and then they have this wonderful tunnel which they walked down. It's like about half a mile long, made of brick. It's like an old Victorian sewer in the nicest possible way.
Amazing.
And yeah, so when they appear, they're just greeted by this incredible noise because it's the first their fans have seen of them all night is when they arrive out for the game.
It's like the complete opposite of the Tunnel Club.
Plus, if you're going to warm up on the pitch, it's a serious walk. Like it's
so that is the warm-up.
To get there and back is quite a hike.
Philippe, you mentioned there the celebration from Heung-min Son. Since Monday's pod, Tottenham were successful in getting his red card overturned for that tackle on Andre Gomez. I think we all agreed last pod that would be the right thing to do. So well done, decision makers. Another positive for Spurs that we must discuss, Giovanni Lo Celso getting his first goal on his first start. It came at the end of 15 seconds of total chaos. Kane hitting the post, Son having a shot blocked, and then hits the bar when it looked easier for him to actually score, and finally it then dropped for Lo Celso.
And it's, the good news is we're starting to see some impact by the acquisitions, as in Ndombele, we've seen a bit more. We're seeing Lo Celso, and even Cessinho, the lesser-spotted Cessinho, was spotted in this part in Belgrade.
Well, he'd been injured for a while, hadn't he?
I know,
he? So,
but that's...
You know, they signed him injured.
Absolutely. Mm. So it's if they can actually bring the three players who were supposed to have, I wouldn't say transformative effect, but certainly have an impact, a positive impact on the squad, maybe that could be, you know, another straw to clutch at.
Yeah, very much so. Straw to clutch. It's not that well, I suppose it is a little bit desperate at the moment. In the same group, Bayern Munich beat Olympiakos 2-0. Robert Lewandowski scoring the opener, the eighth Champions League group stage game in a row that he's scored in. So he's now got 39 in all competitions in 2019. That's three more than the next best in Europe's top five leagues, which is Messi. Ivan Perisic got a second late on, and so that is pretty much Bayern through to the last 16.
Lewandowski has, I think with producer Jonathan, we checked that, but we think he's scored in every single one of his 15 last starts.
Amazing.
Which is pretty exceptional in all competitions.
Yeah, absolutely is. Big fun news from Germany. Bayern Munich have already held talks with Arsene Wenger for the vacant manager's job. He's apparently the clear favourite to take over until the end of the season before they then try for a more long-term solution. Bayern apparently scoped out Ralf Rangnick, who works for Red Bull currently, but he'd only moved for a job in England. Come on then, other potential replacements?
Well, I'm not so sure that's true about Arsene Wenger. He has said he was working as a pundit on beIN Sport during the week, and he said he would be interested in the job. Tabloids here are saying that he has been approached, but one-time friend of the show, now enemy of the show, Rafa Honigstein, who knows, who knows a thing or two about German football and Bayern Munich in particular. He has said in The Athletic that Bayern Munich are not, Wenger is not on their shortlist. Now, Honigstein could be right, could be wrong. I'd be more inclined to take his word for it than anyone else's.
There are quite a few people in Germany, to be fair, to what's been written over here, including in this August paper. There are quite a few sources in Germany who have given some credence to the rumour. So it's not just what Wenger said when he was interviewed on beIN Sport. And it would be actually very karmic because he was proposed that job when he was at Monaco. He turned it down out of loyalty for Monaco, and he was sacked by Monaco seven games later. And it's always been at the back of Wenger's mind. And to be honest, I have to say, you get a very good manager, whatever happened at Arsenal at the end, who speaks perfect German, which is very, very useful indeed, knows the culture, the Bundesliga culture, as well as any German. You get him until the end of the season. I think that's not such a stupid call at all.
It's not just the tabloids here, Barry. Christian Falk, head of football at Bild in Germany, was reporting last night that there have already been talks.
Well, that's probably where the tabloids here picked it up from. Mm. It sounds like a no-brainer to me, to be honest, but I'm just saying that he may not have had an approach yet.
You're being a journalist. You're putting all sides of the story across. Well done you.
I'm sitting on the fence, covering my arse.
Not enough of that these days, yeah. Barry, sitting on the fence.
What's great, Philippe, is that in Italian, both Munich and Monaco are Monaco.
That's beautiful. And I might use it at some point. Thank you very much, Nikki.
Right, that's it for part one. Part two will start at Anfield. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We have some live shows for you coming up November the 27th. Indigo at the O2 in London. It's the last chance to see Football Weekly live in London for a while. Max Barry, Jonathan Wilson and Ellis James there for that. In December, on the 20th, we're back in Leeds at the Belgrave Music Hall. Max Lars, Jonathan Wilson and one other. And then a double header in Dublin. January the 27th and 28th at Liberty Hall. Max and Barry plus two others. Right, Liverpool 2, Genk 1. Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, really growing into this season, isn't he? Some mm-hmm. kind of suggestion that he may have played his way into the starting lineup for Sunday's game.
Do you think so? I'd be delighted.
Why do you not think so, Philippe?
Because I think this game on Sunday is going to be, we're going to come to that, a very cagey affair, not unlike what we had last season at Anfield. And that not losing might be a priority, and that Oxlade-Chamberlain brings something that this Liverpool midfield perhaps doesn't have when he's not around, in terms of his directness. He's somebody who goes past people, provokes people. He's also got a very good shot from distance. So he does change this Liverpool midfield, gives him a bit more dynamism as well. And he's been there in, you know, we remember what he did actually against Manchester City last season, mm-hmm. but a different competition, and where he was actually absolutely crucial in Liverpool's qualification. But you want to play Fabinho, right? I mean, you want to play Fabinho. So it's then two out of Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, the captain Jordan Henderson, the evergreen James Milner, the very efficient Wijnaldum, not forgetting Naby Keita, who also does bring something different. You know, unless you play two at the front, which I don't think is going to happen. But anyway, it's very good news for Liverpool that he's coming through and coming good at the moment.
Yeah, and scored the winner against.
And a very good winner too.
Absolutely.
I'm just wondering what Adam Lallana has done to upset Philippe.
And Adam Lallana, no, I absolutely love him. It's just that, well, you could also say Shadan Shaqiri as well, who's not exactly a bad player. Mm.
It feels a little bit like splitting hairs, given that they've won 14 of their 19 games and drawn another four. But Liverpool have now gone 8 games without keeping a clean sheet, in which time they've conceded 14 goals in total. Obviously, that includes the 5-5 against Arsenal and the 4-3 win over Salzburg. But still, just 3 clean sheets in all competitions this season. Is that something to worry for them going forward?
I don't think you can underestimate the firing power of Genk. I wouldn't be too concerned. I mean, that's one of those games you just go, get it done, come home, hope no one gets hurt. And defence is an issue for Liverpool, but it is also an issue for Manchester City. Yes, it's a source of concern. I wouldn't be losing sleep over it, particularly, you know, the rate they're banging. I mean, you know, it's football. If you let in 3 and you're scoring 4, that's fine. It's not a problem.
I mean, I guess it's no secret, I think, that they're missing Joel Matip and how well he was, you know, established, I guess, as the partner to Van Dijk before that. I know that I think Gomez has not started back-to-back games this season. So whether or not Klopp sort of made these comments about him lacking rhythm, and I feel like he hasn't given him a chance, perhaps, to get rhythm. But I do think that Liverpool are vulnerable at the back more than they would like to be. But exactly as Baz has just said, City will be also, and especially if Claudio Bravo insists on going on these sort of great voyages he likes to go on.
Zuma-like raids.
Yeah.
They might, on yesterday's performance, they might put Kyle Walker in goal. You know, Pep could shock us all. He is revolutionary, don't forget. Right, so this game at the weekend, last season's top two, first versus second, the two best teams in the country by a country mile. Liverpool will finish the weekend top, but their lead could be anywhere between 4 and 9 points. Come on, Barry. What do you think is going to happen this weekend?
I think Liverpool are going to win, but I could be wrong. If you put a gun to my head, that's what I would say is going to happen. I would love for it to be an expansive, exciting game like Chelsea-Ajax, and such has been the sort of issues in defence for both teams. We could get a game like that, but I suspect, as Philippe said, it would be quite cagey and possibly another one of those games we all anticipate and build up in for the week before it starts and then finish going, well, that was a bit crap.
The one reason why should a gun be put to my head, to use this worrying image, I would also go for Liverpool, as more to do with the fact that every time that a question has been asked of them this season, they've answered it. Mm. And sometimes they went to get that answer in an area, in a place, or with players which you didn't expect to play such a role. It could be Oxlade-Chamberlain one day, it could be Wijnaldum another, it could be Milner, or Adam Lallana indeed. And every time they've been in a difficult position, they found a way to prevail. Whereas City have had ups and downs. And when they've been down, there was no plan B, plan C, plan Z, whatever you would call it, all this miraculous intervention from somebody you wouldn't expect to intervene. It hasn't happened. Liverpool, there seems to be a kind of almost like fate-like, something like fate at work here. And there's such a belief in it. So you could, on one hand, say, yes, they've won number of games by only the single goal and sometimes lucky goals, and that shows that they're not quite as good as they used to be. You could also see that as, well, they might not be as good, but they're better at winning.
So nobody so far has splinters in their backside. Come on, Nicky.
I'm unfortunately and therefore undoubtedly condemning Liverpool to defeat, I also think Liverpool are going to win. I mean, they got to rest a few players against Genk. I think Lovren, Robertson, Mane, Firmino all out of the starting 11 for that game. Little bit of extra fire in it from Guardiola's wonderfully phrased, sometimes he's diving, of Mane. I don't know, I just think Liverpool are going to... I think even despite all those goals they've conceded, I just trust them more at the moment. I think City clearly still have so much ability and capacity to sweep teams away. But then you see even games like the one against Atalanta where you think, well, this is just so utterly in hand at half time. But only scored one and then suddenly it wasn't. And yeah, they did a good job of keeping the ball away from Atalanta once they had Kyle Walker in goal. But what chances did they really create in that second half? Almost nothing.
This game strikes me as one of those where Pep might do that thing where he tries to be, it's such a big game, he tries to be just a little bit too clever and it backfires on him. And I'd be interested to see if that will happen and in what way this attempt to be a little bit too clever will manifest itself.
Kyle Walker in goal.
Exactly. That would just be hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. Between this game and Christmas, Liverpool's Premier League fixtures will be against Palace, Brighton, Everton, Bournemouth and Watford. On paper, all extremely winnable games. In the same period of time, Manchester City have to play Chelsea, Newcastle, Burnley, Man United, Arsenal and Leicester, which you would presume would be pretty tough. I've seen your face, Philippe. That's
I'd
exactly
say
what
most
you think.
Of them are pretty winnable as well.
Leicester?
Yeah.
But Chelsea? On current form?
Mm-hmm.
But they're Manchester City.
They are Manchester City.
Pretty much every game they play is extremely winnable.
Well, that's very true, but they have not won them all, have they? They might be winnable, but they haven't won them all. Yeah. So you get the feeling that Sunday's going to be crucial in the title race this season. It was also announced this week that Liverpool will play two games in 2 days in December. Aston Villa on Tuesday the 17th of December, and then their Club World Cup semi-final on the 18th. So surely they're going to use two separate squads.
Yes.
Which one are they going to prioritise?
Woof. The Club World Cup, I would imagine. Mm. I mean, The League Cup is a distraction. Club World Cup, that's a trophy of a sort, I suppose.
Yeah. More prestigious without wanting to be
more prestigious.
Disrespectful.
You're Manchester United dropping out of the FA Cup to play
Correct.
The Club World Cup.
Absolutely, which created absolute scandal at the time.
Yeah. I can't believe that it's even an issue as to which you'd prioritise. You obviously have to prioritise the Club World Cup, particularly as they've never won it.
And also because of where it's taking place, because of the commercial impact of that particular competition. If you win it, it does have an impact. There are some parts of the world, perhaps, where it's taken seriously. And it's a trophy. So, whereas the Carabao Cup or the League Cup, and well, is a trophy of a kind, but you just have to remember how Liverpool competed, if that's the word, in the League Cup last season, where basically they played it and didn't play it. So, no problem. Just the kids.
Just a round off Group E in the Champions League. Napoli drew 1-1 with Salzburg. Erling Braut Haaland scoring a penalty for Salzburg in the 11th minute, becoming just the fourth player to score in all of his first four Champions League games. Does he need any extra confidence? Do you know who the other three are, by the way?
Mbappe?
No.
Zé
Carlos, Alessandro Del Piero and Diego Costa.
My goodness.
Yeah, there we go. Anyway.
I can't believe Diego Costa was once a teenager.
Yeah.
Well, was he really?
But he didn't look like one.
No.
So Napoli rescuing a point in the end, Nikki, but there's trouble brewing behind the scenes.
So they started the beginning of this week in Ritiro, which is sort of this very Italian scenario in which the team sort of gets sent off to a variously described as sort of punitive or, you know, team building, but training camp in which no one's been given a chance to say no to. It's sort of decided for them, you're not going home to your families tonight, you're coming to the team training base and we're going to stay here until the next game. And that's because they had failed to win any of their three previous games against Spal, Atalanta and Roma. And after this draw, the Eduardo De Laurentiis, who's the son of Aurelio De Laurentiis, the team owner, came to the change room and said, right, you know, didn't win, going back to Ritiro, and basically the players mutinied. From what's come out today, it sounds like the players had sort of talked about this possibility beforehand and said, look, win, lose, draw, if we get told to go back, we're not doing it. And Mertens sort of spoke first on behalf of this core group, but there's, you know, secondhand reporting, but this is what's in the Italian papers this morning, spoke on behalf of this group, which is sort of led by him and then Alan and Lorenzo Insigne and some other senior players, and basically said, well, you can say what you want, we're not going. And there's sort of unhappiness there about, I think in the greater sense, very few footballers are very happy when they get told you're not going home tonight, you're being treated like school children and packed off for being naughty. But also the way the initial decision to go to Ritiro after the last game was handled, they basically found out about it through the press rather than through the club, and so there was already some sort of bad blood about how that had happened. But essentially, yes, they said no. Yesterday we had Aurelio De Laurentiis, again team owner, threatening to sue everybody, threatening to withhold wages, threatening to get lawyers involved. And he's not generally a man who backs down on these things. He's someone who's is quite sort of fierce when it comes to winning these battles. But it seems as though he has backed down today and is no longer planning to take anyone to court, and has sort of said, okay, then, well, if this is what's been decided, prove that you were right and go and win the games. But the impact on his relationship with the manager, Carlo Ancelotti, is right at the centre of this, because sort of up till now they've been best buds, really. And Ancelotti is not a manager known for going against ownership. And he didn't speak after the game. He didn't do his press appearance after the game against Salzburg, which, you know, there's some suggestion that he wasn't necessarily even on the side of the players, but didn't sort of feel like he had anything he could say, given the decision had been taken with either way. It's very fractious at the moment in Naples, which is strange, because even though this isn't a great individual result, given that they'd already won in Salzburg, they're in a very strong position in the group still. So you wouldn't have thought of this as a breaking point necessarily for the team. But combined with results in the league, which haven't been great, yes, things have suddenly got very tense there for Carlo.
Yeah, as you say, they are in a decent position, third in the group. So Liverpool top on 9 points, then Napoli on 8, Salzburg 4 and Genk at the bottom on 1. Now to round up the rest of the Champions League action in Group F, Borussia Dortmund 3, Inter Milan 2. Milan 2-0 up at half-time as well, Nikki.
Yeah, they were. The first half of this game, Inter were spellbinding. I mean, and very similar, actually, now to what happened in the Barcelona game, where they went away to the Nou Camp and also lost. Antonio Conte's Inter, when they play well, are playing really, really good football. Such sort of fast interchanges. Lautaro Martinez, who scored the first goal, is in unbelievable form. Vecino's goal was lovely as well. Mm. They were just totally in control at halftime, had played Dortmund off the park and had everyone in Italy raving about how good they were. And then in the second half, they just completely went to pieces. And there's an element of this which is clearly about the way they are playing. They're obviously very much a team in Conte's image. They press very aggressively. They are extremely high tempo. And they clearly got a bit tired, a bit nervous, and lost all that sort of momentum they had. But striking disparity between the two halves, because in the second half, Dortmund were rampant. It was completely one-sided again. And the again, as with Napoli, is almost more interesting than the game itself, becomes what happens afterwards, which is Conte comes out after the game and just in that way he has sets fire to everything, doesn't sort of go quietly and acknowledge maybe he made some mistakes, starts, as he had at the weekend actually, even when Inter won, starts tearing into the club for apparent mismanagement of the transfer window, talks about how we don't have any experience in this side, when I'm looking for solutions, all I'm seeing is a guy we brought from Cagliari and a guy we brought from Sassuolo. That's Nicolò Barella and Stefano Sensi, who've been two of his best players this season, by the way. So not only sort of setting fire to the club, but I felt like that was a really clumsy way of talking about two young players who've been so good for you this season, quite disrespectful. Inter spent give or take 150 million euros in the transfer window this summer. They bought Sensi and Barella, as already mentioned. They bought Lukaku. They brought in Alexis Sanchez. They I would argue you could make a case that outside of when he was in charge of the national team, Conte has never had this much a squad this much tailored in his image. I mean, Juventus, his departure from there was actually linked to the fact they wouldn't sign him Lukaku. Lukaku's this player he's wanted. And Lukaku's doing well, by the way, although he hasn't scored in the Champions League yet. So the idea that he hasn't got what he wants is absurd. There are more players he wanted. He also wanted Edin Dzeko as his alternative to Lukaku up front. He also wanted he wanted Arturo Vidal in midfield. He wanted Llorente if he couldn't get Dzeko, because he wants the moon on a stick, right? Because he wants absolutely everything. But to turn around and act as if he hasn't got options, or even to turn around and act as if his players should be any more tired than anyone else's. I mean, I think I can't remember who put this on Twitter now, but someone put on Twitter, because he keeps talking about how tired his squad is, Inter have got something like six players who've played 1,000 minutes or more this season in all competitions, and Liverpool have something like 11. So it's not a reasonable excuse. It's just this sort of immediate impulse to blame someone other than himself. And it's so frustrating because he's doing a good job. Inter, where they were last season, and Inter, where they are now, they're second in the table, they're a point off, they've won 9 out of 11 games and drawn another in Serie A, they're playing well. And in the first 45 minutes of this was some of the best football I've seen out of Inter in years. In years.
Well, the second goal is it's a little masterpiece of, if you want people to know what is Conte football at its absolute best, that's the one. It's just beautiful.
And yet he sort of insists on undoing so much of his good work by raging about non-existent injustices, things that no sensible person could look at and go, yes, you've had a really tough time there, Antonio, like it's ridiculous. So instead of it was in the end of course a disappointing result, because they were behind the eight ball in this group before the first game against Dortmund, so they are now third, but instead of being a performance which you could look at and go, okay, well, frustrating result, some good, some bad, you just look at it and think, how long can this even last? How long can it last of an ownership that has spent 150 million euros for you in the summer going, yes, sorry, we haven't done enough. It's ridiculous.
It's a very important result for Borussia Dortmund as well, and for Lucien Favre in particular, because there were loads of noises around his being in danger at the club. Had they lost by quite a wide margin, which what you know we were fearing.
It looked like it could have been a run.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the way they reacted and the way some of the players who perhaps have been a bit underwhelming, particularly Julian Brandt, who I absolutely love, but we haven't quite seen him at his best yet. He had a cracking second half, and Hakimi had also a cracking second half. And the way they went back, brought the public back with him, I mean, it's probably going to give him a little bit of breathing space in a completely crazy Bundesliga season.
Yeah, Borussia Dortmund second on 7 points in Group F. Barcelona top on 8 points after a goalless draw in the other match with the rank outsiders, Slavia Prague.
Who were brilliant. They were brilliant.
Slavia Prague, by the way, they're going to finish bottom of that group and they're going to be forgotten. But actually, if people remember when the draw was made, their directors were laughing at how hard the draw was. They were sort of genuinely that sort of look of laughter and fear all at once. They have acquitted themselves really well in so many of these games, and of course they already drew with Inter. It's not going to be enough, but they're good team, actually.
And without wanting to be disrespectful in the slightest to Slavia Prague, you know, a goalless draw against Barcelona, great for them, not so great for Barcelona. And Arsene Wenger, talking on beIN Sports afterwards, said despite being leaders of La Liga and their Champions League group, they are playing like a club in crisis. Is that a fair point?
Completely. It's awful to watch. It's a kind of... it's a bit like watching Arsenal, but Arsenal that would actually win a few games. It's that bad. Some of the things are incomprehensible. And one of the things that, probably the most incomprehensible of all of those, is the way that Antoine Griezmann, who is genuinely one of the best footballers in the world, has still not been integrated and is still not being passed the ball. It's absolutely unbelievable. There's obviously something so rotten in that dressing room. He's obviously ostracized. He should be one of their main weapons. He's not. And when I was watching the game, actually, at one point I made the conscious choice of I'm going to watch his runs and what his teammates are doing. He was doing all these runs, waiting for the ball to arrive. The ball didn't come to him once. So that's bad. And when you add to that the fact that Suarez is hit and miss a bit, that there are loads of players who look a bit superannuated, and Messi can't do everything on his own at his age anymore. The fact that Valverde is a manager who is actually reviled now by the fans of Barcelona. You think, no, this is actually, it is a crisis situation, amazingly enough.
In Group A, Real Madrid 6, Galatasaray 0. Real were 3 up inside quarter of an hour. Rodrigo scoring in the 4th and 7th minute. Then a Ramos Penenka in the 14th. And in the 92nd minute, Rodrigo completing a perfect hat-trick. Right foot, left foot, header. 18 years and 301 days old. He's the second youngest player to score a hat-trick in the Champions League after Raul, who did it about 6 months quicker. In the other match in Group A, PSG qualified for the knockout stages. Philippe, not quite the 5-0 that they beat Bruges by 2 weeks ago.
No.
But Icardi got the only goal of the game. They've qualified for the last 16. Keylor Navas saved them, though.
Yeah, it was yet another disappointing performance coming on the back of absolute nightmarish show against Dijon in the French League. It's a strange club at the moment. It's a strange team. I mean, Tuchel is not exactly getting on with the sports director, Leonardo, which is not exactly a surprise if you think of Tuchel's past dealings with Borussia Dortmund, for example. There's the Neymar situation, which is still not hasn't been sorted. There are too many players who are too comfortable. When they put on a show, they can be absolutely superb. Absolutely superb. But unfortunately, this is a team, again, it's probably the 17,000th time I've said that, they're in need of a psychologist as much as of a manager. It's just incomprehensible the way they do not turn up for games. And this was, again, the case. You think, you know, do the job, qualify and so forth, but it was actually a bit iffy.
Mm.
Incredible.
In Group G, RB Leipzig won 2-0 at Zenit to stay top of the group. They need just a point to qualify for the knockouts now. Lyon beat Benfica 3-1, so they move into second. Difficult start for them this season, Philippe. They lie 10th in Liga, but are things turning around?
Hard to tell. They did the Brazilian gamble at the beginning of the season, bringing in Silvinho, completely inexperienced as the manager, a former Arsenal left-back. With Juninho Pernambucano as a sports director, was of course a hero at Lyon. It didn't work out after a promising first two games, then it went completely wrong. Then they took on Rudy Garcia, who is a very unpopular choice as a manager for Lyon. The results in the league haven't been great, but they have got actually a decent squad, if you look at it. And we're starting to see the Memphis Depay, whom we love to see with the Dutch national team, we're starting to see him with Lyon as well. And Aouar, who is a marvelous player whom we'd hardly seen, suddenly turns up a very good performance. And they've got great potential. It's just a question of harnessing it and getting some results. And in this case, I mean, they look actually in a decent position now in this group.
Yeah, just to round off the Champions League in Group D, Juventus qualify for the knockouts by beating Lokomotiv Moscow 2-1. Aaron Ramsey becoming the first British player to score for Juve.
Can we talk about that? Because it was wonderful. Like, it's Cristiano Ronaldo, who's taken a million free kicks from Juventus and never scored, also had a chance to move ahead of Messi and Raul as having scored against the most Champions League opponents. I think it would have been 34. And the ball is going in, and Ramsey just sort of touches it on the line. I mean, it is absolutely like three-quarters of the way over the line, and Ramsey just gets a toe on it and steals it from him.
Is that going to cause ructions in the dressing room?
I don't think serious ones, but I think there's no question that Ronaldo was pretty peeved about it.
Anyone else you might have a laugh about? I would imagine he was most displeased.
Just finally, Bayer Leverkusen sprung a shock, beating Atletico Madrid 2-1. A marvellous own goal from Thomas Partey there.
Nearly scored the second one as well. Extraordinary, Thomas. He nearly scored a second own goal in that game. A pity.
It was a fantastic round of Champions League action, I have to say. There were so many stories, so much excitement going on. Last night there was some early Europa League action as well. Arsenal away at Vitória Guimarães. 1-1 the score. But it's the fourth game in a row, Barry, where Arsenal have gone ahead and been pegged back to a draw. What's going on?
They're just not very good, to be honest. They were absolutely appalling last night.
Baz, not even night.
Oh, yes.
3:50.
3:50 in the afternoon. Someone put up the Arsenal passing map and on Twitter. It's 589 passes, I think, 520 successful, one of which went into the Vitória penalty area, and that was the goal they scored from, a Nicolas Pepe free kick. They're just so ponderous, just passing the ball from side to side to side. And if you compare the speed with which Chelsea were getting the ball forward against Ajax to what Arsenal were doing yesterday, it was just, you know, apples and oranges. Now, admittedly, Unai Emery made 8 changes from the team that drew with Wolves, so it was very much a below-strength team. And Rob Holding was the captain because none of the 4 designated captains who were left since Granit Xhaka got stripped of the captaincy. So
that was the news pre-match.
Yeah,
that Unai Emery confirmed that Granit Xhaka has been relieved of the captaincy. Some, because of that, are suggesting he might not stay at Arsenal past January.
Yeah, there was talk this morning that AC Milan are interested. Look, I've always been absolutely baffled by the English, and it seems to be an entirely English obsession with who captains football teams. I just do not get it. It's absolutely irrelevant. But it should be pointed out that Rob Holding did win the toss in the process, totally justifying his manager's decision to hand in the armband yesterday afternoon. Maybe he should keep it. He's clearly got quite a gift for all the skills required
50-50.
for a captain. they were terrible yesterday, conceded an equaliser, and Vitória had much the better chances in the game. Arsenal bossed possession, Vitória bossed the shooting stats and had 4 on target to Arsenal's 1. And Emiliano Martinez in the Arsenal goal had to make at least 3 good saves, I think.
Tonight, more Europa League. Some bad news coming out overnight, actually. The BBC's Chris McLaughlin reporting that 2 Celtic fans were stabbed outside the Flann O'Brien pub in Rome. Nicky, violence from Italian ultras on European nights, unfortunately, just not especially rare.
Yes, this is being reported in Italy. La Repubblica have said it was Lazio ultras, so it certainly wouldn't be a surprise if that is the case. We saw when they were in Glasgow, a group of them making fascist salutes, marching through the centre of Glasgow. Celtic fans responded with the banner that showed Mussolini being hung by his feet and said, "Follow your leader." So I think that there has been sort of some antagonism that led a lot of us to expect that there was likely to be a reaction when we got back to Rome, given that we know the Lazio ultras have previous for getting involved in these sorts of I don't even know if altercation is the right word, attack perhaps, but yes, it's horrible stuff either way, and I wish I had something optimistic to say about this being dealt with in a constructive way, but it's happened too many times to feel that way.
We send our best wishes to those fans and hope they make a full recovery. In the game itself, Celtic will as much as qualify if they beat Lazio. Nikki, while we're on ultras, there's been a development on the racism story at Verona from the weekend.
Yes, so after Mario Balotelli was racially abused by the Verona ultras, a section of their stadium will be closed for the next game. And also Luca Castellini, who is the ultra who came out with a grim statement trying to say that Balotelli can never be completely Italian. He has been banned from the stadium for 11 years, I think, until 2030.
Manchester United host Partizan Belgrade. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer saying he wants United to fill their boots. They won the reverse fixture 1-0. You're shaking your head, Philippe. You might shake your head at this as well in a second. Ashley Young said in the pre-match presser that Solskjaer reminds him of Sir Alex Ferguson. Interesting. Philippe, Philippe has his head resting up against the microphone in despair.
Yeah, I'm not sobbing uncontrollably. I just can't believe it. Feel their boots. First of all, this is extremely disrespectful. When is the last time that Manchester United filled their boots against anyone? That was a while ago, wasn't it? Compared to Chelsea, well, 4-0, which is...
And we're all still trying to figure out how that happened.
Exactly. Well, it was crazy. And the idea of... I don't know. I have nothing to say. To be honest, it's what Manchester United, what comes out of it at the moment is utterly irrelevant. And I don't pay any attention to it. Is that a bit severe, perhaps?
Well...
just I'm bored with it. It's like the same mediocrity... week after week after week, and all the same things that we're on the right path. We are improving, or we will improve. This is crazy.
Well, it's like Liverpool under Gerard Houllier when they were constantly turning a corner. So then they turn the corner three times and then back exactly where they start.
They want things. They won the UEFA Cup. They won the League Cup. They won the FA Cup. They won the Super Cup. They won loads of things, and it was like
I think they're kind of struggling to stay relevant at the moment, because people are talking about Chelsea, people are talking about Leicester, people are looking at Manchester, beaten by Bournemouth, shoulder shrug.
Yeah.
So I think there is a kind of struggle to stay for relevance. But now that they're being linked with a Saudi takeover, that'll catapult them back into the public eye, front
centre. I'm going to resume my position.
Yeah.
Leave your head there. Wolves play Slovan Bratislava. They won in Bratislava, of course, a fortnight ago. And Rangers play Porto after getting an unexpected draw in the reverse tie in Portugal. In League One, Ipswich went top on goal difference with a 1-0 win at Rochdale. Third place Peterborough lost for the second game in a row, going down 1-0 at Shrewsbury. And Portsmouth beat Southend 4-1. Southend just have one point from their last eight games. That will do for part two. We'll start part three by looking ahead to this weekend's Premier League fixtures. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly Extra. The Premier League. We've already touched on the big game of the weekend, Liverpool against Manchester City. Probably the next biggest game to discuss is Leicester against Arsenal. Could be important in the Champions League race. Arsenal currently fifth, 6 points behind both Chelsea and Leicester. We've already had a damning report on Arsenal, so let's talk all things Leicester. They've been pretty impressive, haven't they, Barry?
Yes, and I would expect them to win this game, particularly on the evidence of what I saw from Arsenal's game against Vitoria. Leicester are impressive in pretty much every department. They're banging in goals. They have a plan. They're incisive going forward. Everything Arsenal aren't, really. And I would be surprised if Leicester didn't win this game.
Spurs against Sheffield United is really interesting. Not many would have predicted that Spurs would be 3 points behind them when this fixture came around. Total opposites in terms of form as well. Spurs are in 11th, 4 games without winning the league. Sheffield United unbeaten in 4. They're in 6th and have conceded the joint fewest goals as well, just 8 in 11 games. Bearing in mind Spurs have had a confidence boosting win in the Champions League, what are you expecting from this one, Philippe?
I think this will give us a much better idea of where Tottenham are at the moment, because the last performances haven't been that bad, to be absolutely honest. There have been moments where they looked almost like the Tottenham of old or not so long ago. But Sheffield United do pose questions that nobody seems to be able to answer, which is quite extraordinary. I mean, they're a very unexpected side in terms of how they play. Nobody seems to have figured out a way of countering this very strange system, which is unique probably in Europe, actually. And you would think at one point somebody's going to find out how to deal with those overlapping centre-backs or whatever it is, and with the system that Wilder has put in place. But so far, no, nobody has done that. And they're gaining in confidence. So it will be, I think, a good test of seeing where Spurs, I mean, without any disrespect to Sheffield United here, but should Spurs actually fail to beat them? Now you're talking about something pretty serious, because we're looking at what? Something like 13 points in 12 games or something like that.
Which are you talking crisis?
Yes, but anyway, we're already in a crisis. I mean, I don't think we've been in a crisis for a while, and the crisis has been papered over by what happened in the Champions League, which was a miracle. But they're losing so many games that, you know. But again, I feel there are elements in Tottenham at the moment, in the performances, if not in the results, which are mildly encouraging, I think. Some players getting back to their level, better collective performances, still loads of question marks about a number of aspects of the way the club is going at the moment and what's going to be there in the future. But for me, I mean, that's an absolutely huge game for them.
Yeah, I think Son in particular, that he was able to sort of get what happened at the weekend out of his system and score is obviously a big thing. But if we talk about the Champions League, getting them back on track, I just don't see how you can sort of expect that going on what's happened this season. I mean, they've had some big wins this season. They beat Palace 4-0. Next two games, they drew with Olympiacos, lost to Leicester. They beat Red Star at home 5-0. Next games, lost to Liverpool and drew with Everton. Like, they haven't at any point this season been able to follow up a win and turn it into some momentum, and so to expect it feels like too much. I think it's crazy when you look at that league table and realize it's now 11 games played and only 3 wins. I mean, it's also crazy, you know, in terms of the league table, you look at Arsenal, who are ahead of them for now, but it's 11 league games, only 4 wins. These are teams that should be winning more than, you know, 30-40% of their games.
But credit has to go to teams like Sheffield United, yeah, because it isn't necessarily just because the so-called bigger teams are not having good seasons. The so-called smaller teams, without wanting to be patronising in the slightest, are having great seasons.
They're objectively smaller, so there's nothing patronising about it.
But some fans find it like that, which you can understand. I'm not going to ask you, Philippe, about Manchester United.
No.
1 win in 6 in the league. They face a Brighton side who've won 3 of their last 4 and lie 2 places above them. I mean, it's almost like the table has just been flipped around. I find it, as somebody who supports a team outside of the Premier League, I'm finding the Premier League switched like this absolutely fascinating. But this is another game difficult to call, Barry.
I would be inclined to think Brighton would win it, but Manchester United are capable of pulling out a decent performance at home. Brighton, their players finally got the hang of what it is that Graham Potter wants them to do. They clicked against Spurs in that magnificent 3-0 win at the Amex Stadium a few weeks ago. I think if they do beat Manchester United in this game, there will be a lot of very, very unhappy people in the stands at Old Trafford. And I think it'll be a bit like at Arsenal, where they'll all be very, very angry, but they won't quite know who to direct their anger at. And I'd be interested to see who would be blamed. You know, it's the Glazers they ultimately want gone from the club, but there is a lot of blame to go around for what's currently going on at Old Trafford.
We have a top of the table clash and a bottom of the table clash this weekend as well, as Norwich face Watford, 19th against 20th. Norwich's big problem, obviously, is defence. They've conceded 27 goals in their 12 games in all competitions this season. Watford actually struggling up front. So they've just scored twice in the last 9 hours of play. Arguably, Ben Foster at the moment, one of their best players. It's the movable object against the stoppable force is what producer Jonathan has written in here. And that pretty much sums it up, Nikki.
Yes, it's hard to find positive things to say about either of these teams at the moment. I'm struggling a little bit.
I think that it's a chance. I mean, this first win of the season for Watford, I think, could be around the corner in this particular one. I mean, in fairness, Norwich have had huge problems in terms of personnel, missing so many players out for so long. It's been very difficult for them to build on. We haven't forgotten their extraordinary win over Manchester City.
Yeah, but since Pukki stopped scoring, everything is...
Yeah, I know.
No one else is scoring.
Yeah,
they exactly. have had a terrible luck with injuries, though. Yep. That needs to be factored in.
Also at the weekend, on Saturday, 5:30 kickoff, England women against Germany, 90,000, it's a sellout. Pre-match, Laura Bassett, Karen Carney and Claire Rafferty are going to be honoured after they all retired this year. We got a lovely email from Patricia to say, I casually asked my son's year four class if anyone wanted to join me at the match, thinking maybe one or two people would come along. Within 24 hours, 72 of us booked, and we're now going as a big group. This is a real special moment for women's sport. Could beat the world record attendance for a women's football match, which was just over 80,000 set in 2012 at the Olympic final between USA and Japan. I couldn't believe that it was 5 years since the Lionesses last played at Wembley and they lost 3-0 to Germany. I know, exactly, Philippe.
It's crazy. That's
insane.
But now they've proved they can sell it out. Phil Neville, when I was at his press conference last week, said he wants to make this an annual event. The biggest crowd at Wembley for a Lionesses game was back in 2014. That was 45,619. I mean, I'm going. I'm taking my niece and nephew, my sister, my dad's coming too. It's like a really big thing for us. And I feel like the atmosphere is going to be astounding. You've got something to say, Barry.
Yeah, you're not going to like it. But what is the obsession with attendances by people who cover women's football? That's all they seem interested in.
Because it's the
how many people were at the game.
Because it's the growth of the game. That's the whole point. The whole point is that we have to capitalise on what happened in the summer at the World Cup and the success that the Lionesses had there. And that has to translate into the WSL and also into the national team to get more people
watching.
But
is it translating into the WSL?
Very much so. When you look at the comparison between the number of people that attended matches in the WSL last season, we've smashed that already because we're going to bigger stadiums because more people are finding out about it. The marketing has improved. We've got the FA player now. There's so many things going on to grow the game. We've got a women's football weekend coming up next week. It's really exciting time. So the obsession with the attendances is because it's the only measurable factor of how much the game is growing.
All right. Can I complain about something else instead?
Yeah, go for it.
Phil Neville.
Go on then.
I'm convinced he gets an easy ride from people who cover women's football because I wrote a column about him that was quite critical and I got loads of DMs on Twitter from people telling me, oh yeah, you nailed that about Phil Neville. And I'm kind of going, well, why don't you say it? You cover the sport. I hasten to add you weren't one of them. But I was astonished by, like, my phone just kind of lit up. And I go, well, if this is what you think, why don't you say it?
I think people are starting to say it. They are starting to criticise with the recent results. You can't not, unfortunately. But we must wrap up. And, we did not give enough of a nod to Kyle Walker's turning goal against Atalanta. A lot of questions along the lines of what are the other memorable outfielders in goal incidents?
Well, I remember Niall Quinn as a Manchester City player. Perfect. Going in goal and saving a penalty from Dean Saunders, which was and either protecting Man City's lead or earning them a point in the process. But that's the one that stands out for me.
similar. Phil Jagielka went in goal for Sheffield United against Arsenal and I think made a pretty good save as they kept a 1-0 lead. If I remember right, Neil Warnock basically used to just, he didn't believe in sub goalkeepers. He just basically thought that was a waste of a bench spot. And it turned out he was right, because when he put Jagielka in, it went fine.
The one, it's very obscure, but it's quite a story. It's back in 1982 in France, Bordeaux. Was one of a high-flying team and had a very, very expressive and colourful owner called Claude Béz. And in a game against Lens, the keeper from Bordeaux, Dragan Pantelic, was sent off and also received a year-long suspension for having come to blows with one of the referees. Now, Béz was absolutely furious, so he decided the next game, I'm going to show them. And he named as his keeper... I'm not joking, not inventing this. Alain Giresse, 1.63 meters, 5'4". He named him as his keeper. So Giresse played with the keeper's jersey in midfield. So they played without a keeper. And when their opponents were in possession of the ball, it was Marius Trésor who came back and sort of vaguely, as a central defender, sort of tackled the ball out of the situation, you know, out of the danger zone. And it carried on. And they, I think they were 2-0 down after 6 minutes. But they didn't change their plan. They carried on until the moment when Alain Giresse actually passed on the goalkeeper's jersey to Marius Trésor. And they lost 6-0. And they could have cared less. They'd made their point. So absolutely, that was Claude Béz. This is the way that French football was in the 1980s. And I miss it tremendously.
Amazing, amazing. Right, we've got to end there. Thank you so much. Thank you, Nikki. Lovely to see you.
Good to see you.
Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you.
Cheers, Baz.
You're welcome. Thanks.
That's it for this week's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. And that's my shift done. I'm off to write my intro.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.